Hi, I'm Dr. David Barron from Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School and Newark Beth Israel Medical Center in Newark, New Jersey. My task today is to give you a description of how you do relatively complex things in a relatively quick period of time. How do you basically perform a transplant? What are some of the key steps involved? What goes on and things to look out for during the actual surgical procedure? And then what are key aspects to look out after the transplant that are relevant to a practicing clinician? So before, you have the task of taking a complex structure, oftentimes in limited time, oftentimes in operating theater that you're not used to, and finding out how to take out that heart and then get it back to a distant location. All of this with the pressure of exquisite time and safety. And I think that the important things are to look at the heart in a more simplistic way. If you think about how people tackle heart transplant, look at the heart as a box with four major components, a right and a left side. So on your right side, you have two entries into the right atrium, which is the SVC and IVC. Those lead into the right ventricle. And on the left side, you have four pulmonary veins coming into the left atrium. You, of course, also have outlets. You have blood going out of the left side, blood going out of the right side. So you have two large, great vessels. So initially, the first approach that was discovered and described by Norm Shumway and Richard Lower was to go ahead and cut these, cut the great vessels, and then go ahead and take a slice out of the atrium. And that makes a lot of sense because that took care of the problem of having the SVC and IVC. And when it came to the left side, they did much of the same thing and took a slice out of the left side as well. That avoided the nasty problem of having to anastomose four pulmonary veins and make it work. So it was easy surgery. And that actually led to patients end up having two right atriums. So this technique worked quite well. Cut the great vessels, cut half of the left and right atrium, and you're left where you can put it back in pretty easily. But the problem with that approach and why it's largely been abandoned is because then patients ended up with two right atria. And we have all these nice, fun EKGs that have two atrial spikes, two P waves. And in more recent years, the bicaval approach has been developed, and that basically is cut. So you cut the right SVC above, you cut the IVC below, and depending on how long you want it, you're set. You leave the patient with just one right atrium, but still nobody's found a better way than the original method for the left atrium, just simply slicing and then cutting the great vessels is probably the most straightforward part of the procedure. After that, then, what do you do with the heart? Well, you have your sort of witch's brew. And that could be a variety of things. There are many institutions that develop their own preservation solutions. They all have the same thing in mind. How do you keep the heart not metabolically active so that the heart doesn't die? Because we've all seen patients where they suffer a massive MI, 4 or 5 minutes of ischemia, and they develop irreversible injury. How is it we take the entire heart out, fly across the country, and then it's okay? So this has been pioneered by preservation solutions that not only have things to cause cardioplegia, typically potassium-based solutions, but also things that give the heart nutrients and, the most important, cold. Cold. And so you have ice slush. Melting ice at 4 degrees Celsius tends to be a perfect medium to put the heart in. So it keeps it cold, less metabolically active, and you see it here in the bag. And then we sort of borrowed one from nature and said, well, you certainly don't want to have somebody trip and fall or injure the myocardium as you're traveling. And these days, transplants become relatively routine, so travel is even quicker in a less desirable circumstance. Sometimes helicopters, bouncy things. So we go ahead and put it in a bag, and then another bag, more ice slush, and then another bag after this. Usually this is the job of the transplant fellows, holding the bags. At least that used to be a fun part. I always had these nightmares that I might drop the bag before the heart was all sealed up. But by having that 2 or 3 bag layer of protection, not only makes sure that if something ruptures, the fluid won't leak out, it remains sterile, and it keeps the heart cold so that you're able to do this. And surprisingly, this has not changed much since the late 60s when this technique was developed. While people have changed to bicaval, the preservation largely is the same and can't beat the cost of ice. What about during? So, you know, during the transplant surgery, this is all the domain of the surgeon, encountering the anatomy that they'll find. Their tools are really same standard surgical tools, scalpel, bovie, and the surgical skill to be able to shape the heart after you take out the native heart. And taking out the native heart is exactly a mirror image of what you do with the donor heart. If you're doing a bicaval approach, you're going to cut the SVC and IVC in the patient. You're going to cut the great vessels. Obviously, you have to cut neater than I'm able to draw. And then you're able to suture the things together with your little suture. So surgery, by and large, has also not changed a whole lot. But what's changed is somehow the mechanisms and the patients that we're dealing with. A lot of times, complex congenital patients, patients with situs inversus, patients with previous cardiac surgeries. Sometimes it's a landmine trying to take out the patient who has a ventricular assist device. And taking out the heart is not nearly as simple as it would seem, but beyond the scope of this short presentation. So surgically, assume that your surgeon is able to take the heart out and able to mate the two together. Usually surgeons will start with the left atrial side and then make the four key anastomoses between the great vessels, the SVC and IVC, and the left atrial cuff. And rewarming is really critical. They're also, every surgeon does it a little bit differently, whether they give cardioplegia, cold slush, and whatnot. And we really try to minimize the implant time, the time that the heart's not really sitting on an ice bath, that it's essentially warm ischemic time while the suturing is going on and dealing with sometimes unexpected problems. Other key things surgically to highlight that you may not realize your surgeon has to deal with is things like pacemakers and ICDs. And by the time somebody comes to a transplant these days, they may have numerous types of leads. They may have epicardial leads. They may have things inside that you didn't actually notice on the CAT scan that can make it very tricky and challenging. And oftentimes the innominate vessel where a lot of the ICD leads run can be a challenge to repair. So the during is a big, big aspect. What about after? You know, a lot of times we're very happy, you know, when put the patient off bypass, the heart starts beating. And I would say that it always seems to me a miracle every time when I see the heart go from a limp structure that's just not moving into a fully expanded beating heart. Occasionally I have to give defibrillation, but sometimes it just starts on its own and it always remains one of the really amazing miracles of medicine. But what happens when they get up to the ICU and then you're all alone? It's you and the anesthesiologist and you're trying to deal with what happens. With this point, I think you have to look at the heart in a more linear way, because what goes wrong after the transplant really depends on looking things in a kind of a way of a circuit. You have the right side of the heart. You have this what would look like a resistor, which is the lung, the net component of all the resistance inside the lung, the four pulmonary veins, and then you get to the left side. Left atrium and left ventricle, and obviously blood goes through the systemic circulation and back. So understanding this graph lets you understand what could possibly go wrong. Let's go with the easiest one first. The left ventricle, the pump, doesn't work. Well, that can certainly happen, especially as we tend to go to longer ischemic times. The longer ischemic time you have, the more likely it is that the patient will come off cardiopulmonary bypass, but they may be sluggish. And it's really important to measure with Swan or whatever other technique you want in your ICU to follow the performance. Sometimes the patient may come out great, and then a couple hours later, urine output's down, patient may not look as well. They can't talk to you. They're intubated. They're, you know, I've got chest tubes. But you'll know from your monitoring techniques, whether it's a left atrial line, Swan GANS, continuous cardiac output, that the performance overall is going down. And remember that the Swan and other monitors won't tell you what part's bad. That's your brain. That's this guy that's got to figure out what part is wrong. You'll know, however, that the overall perfusion is bad, particularly if the mixed venous saturation is low. So if that happens, then your friend is to give inotropic agents, of which we tend to use a lot of milrinone and dobutamine, other centers like epinephrine, overseas, levosimendan is an option. Inotropic therapy is very reasonable. Can't overestimate the importance of echocardiography. Obviously, the chest is closed, so if something doesn't look right, echo is your friend along with your hemodynamics. So another thing, sometimes people will use thyroid hormone. What about if it's not the left? You do the echo, maybe you increase the inotropes, patient's still not looking right, whether they're not making enough urine or something else is wrong that's telling you things are bad. Well, other parts of the circuit. What about the right side of the heart? What if the primary dysfunction of the situation is because the right side's not working well? Well, you can see that by echo. By non-invasive means, your central venous pressure, probably your window into the right side, and if your CVP is rising, you must find an explanation. Make sure it's not just an air bubble in it or that it's not zeroed. But if CVP is rising, particularly if the waveform is flattening, that should clue you in that there's a problem. And there are a couple of major kind of problems of the right side you may get. The easiest one first is the right side was fine, the heart was doing great, maybe ischemic time wasn't that long, and now CVP is climbing. And maybe your nurse happens to notice that instead of having a normal tracing like this, the more observant one may notice that now it's flattened out. That should tell you that there's a problem that's probably not related to the pump of the right side, but related to compression and bleeding, especially in this day and age when so many patients have had previous VADs or other cardiac surgery, is a definite indicator. So if you have CVP that starts to rise, particularly if it's flat, other episodes such as mixed venous dropping, urine output, very good indicator that there's a problem. And if there's blood in there, it's got to be fixed. And that's you're going to have to deal with whether it's a cardiothoracic surgeon, an intensivist, milk the chest tubes. You have to do something if the right side is being squished, if your right side is this instead of this. What about if there's no blood? The right side looks fine. It's well expanded. What if it looks really big? What if your right side is this and your left side is this little tiny sort of square? Well, right ventricular dysfunction, primary graft dysfunction from the right side is also another problem. Most of the time you can manage this by recognizing it, by increasing inotropes, and in decreasing the resistor. The link between the right and the left side is really important. So if you find that the right side looks really big and you think in your judgment the right side is why the patient's not doing well, it's either pump this up and give it more juice with inotropes or decrease its work. Remember, especially the pre-op history, if you have a patient with a history of pulmonary hypertension, maybe you reverse it with nipride, but now it comes back to haunt you, that this resistor is maybe this resistor. It's a lot of them. We have good tools. Nitric oxide inhaled, intravenous epoprostenol, inhaled epoprostenol, inhaled milrinone. All of these things can be done to reduce the resistance across the right. Remember, the right ventricle is never really designed to be a high-pressure chamber. Sure as heck, after it's placed on ice for 2 to 4 hours, it becomes even less able to do work. So in the extreme cases, if you have really profound right ventricular failure, you could go on ECMO and drain the blood from the right and give it to the left. You could put in a right ventricular assist device, whether surgical or percutaneous. But most of the time, prompt recognition, drugs, dropping the resistance with a variety of pharmacologic agents is oftentimes enough to really help you. And the knowledge of what kind of graft dysfunction is going on is really important. So it's not just all about echo or about SWAN or about the urine output. It's the integration of all of these. And I tell my fellows, you've got to go to the bedside and examine the patient to try and figure out what it is. You don't have the luxury that the surgeons do of opening the chest and taking a look-see unless you really see a lot of tamponade or something that justifies that kind of intervention. So we've gone now in our steps from finding the donor heart, understanding how we're going to anastomose with either a bicaval or biatrial approach, putting it in our witch's brew, going through surgery where we have our tools to take the heart out safely, always expect the unexpected. It's very important to give the surgeon as much information as possible about what's in there, but there's always surprises. There's no test that will tell you how adherent an ICD lead is or what might happen when the right ventricle is adherent to the sternum, and as you open up, you manage to put a big tear in the right ventricle that you have to deal with while you're waiting for the donor heart to come. And then the after, always remembering looking at the heart in a linear way with the right, the left, and the most critical resistance in between. Once you understand what's wrong, why the patient's not performing post-transplant, you're able to optimize your therapies. And it's actually uncommon for patients to have multiple. If the patient got out of the OR, you can assume that the right ventricle and left ventricle are least adequate. And a lot of times the struggles you have 4 to 8 hours after the transplant are things that are a little bit different. And knowing also how the course was in the OR will definitely help you. Imaging is invaluable to really direct your therapies. And the final message is don't wait too long. If something's wrong in a transplant patient, mobilize your forces, your echo, your hemodynamics, your surgical staff. You don't want to sit on somebody all night long where they're not doing well, not making urine, because transplant as you start is as you finish. And if you start poorly, it can take you days, weeks, or you may never recover from that initial 12 to 24 hours when really you need all your forces to bear to get this all working right. I thank you all.